Hello, I'm Tony Pigg. Welcome to another edition of the Inside Track. Tonight, Lisa Robinson's guests are three original rock and roll rebels. Peter Townsend, who talks about The Who, his solo career, and his personal difficulties. Lou Reed, who tells what was behind Walk on the Wild Side and the live version of Sweet Jane. And Mick Jones of The Clash, who comments on Joe Strummer's disappearance and the unique stance of The Clash. The Inside Track is brought to you by Budweiser. For all you do, this Bud's for you. Lisa Robinson's exclusive radio interview with Pete Townsend will begin right after this.
Hi, I'm Lisa Robinson. When Pete Townsend arrived at London's St. James Men's Club to meet me, he was bearded, had a familiar twinkle in his eye, and looked like the Townsend I had last interviewed 2 years ago. A lot had happened these past 2 years. We'd heard rumors about ill health and emotional problems, but here was Pete, ready to talk for the first time about what had happened. First, however, I wanted to know about the future of The Who.
I think there is now a foreseeable limit to the amount of time that the band will continue in the shape that we're in at the moment. This year is going to be a long, concerted period of work where everybody in the band devotes their time exclusively to the band. Roger and I, to some extent, have agreed, although we've both sort of oscillated a bit, we've agreed that the band has gone past the point where it should have naturally stopped working, that we're more or less free to do what we like. But despite all those very positive things, you know, the fact that we are poised to put a lot of effort in, I do get a feeling that it's a kind of a last waltz, in a sense. In other words, that we won't be able to afford to put in 18 months of totally solid work on the band all that often. But that's what it needs. You know, it won't work with any less.
When you say afford, what do you mean? Emotionally, mentally, physically?
I think really, basically, the band has become very conscious of itself as a group, as a team, each with different roles to play. As a creative clearinghouse, we feel more of a group. In other words, we're feeling that anything that we do in the future, we should all be able to stand by and all feel passionate about. And I think really this might be an abreaction from the fact that the Face Dances record was, like some of our earlier work, seemed to drift very much into a territory where it appeared to be personal to me, you know, a lot of the material, but in actual fact it wasn't, you know, I mean, it was just that it appeared that way. I suppose the band wants to be seen to be standing together. That's the kind of statement, if you like, that we want to make. We get upset when we appear to be fragmenting and drifting, when we know that the reverse is true. So it's like almost to really throw in very heavily and very consciously and show that, you know, we really do care very much about the band's activity and about one another as individuals, about what we've done and what we're doing and what we intend to do.
Since I knew that Pete and I were both big fans of punk rock, I asked Pete what he thought of The Clash.
I do like them. They've got a conscience. One thing that is that they are guilty of is that they're, I think, like everybody, there's an element of hypocrisy there because they're not always leading the lifestyle that they expect other people in power and responsibility to live. One of the reasons they annoy me a bit, I love their music and I think they're a great band and I like them all a lot as people, but one of the things that does annoy me is they seem to throw a lot of opportunities away because they're not really ready to deal with the music business. You know, you've got to get a balance, and you've also got to acknowledge that if you want to get up there and play, somebody's got to build the stage, and that you're not going to be the first on the stage nor the last on the stage, and the stage is going to be there when you're dead and gone. And so you've got to regard the stage as a place of, you know, you're privileged to be there in a sense. You know, no, you don't have to kiss the stage's ass, you know, or the guy that made it, but you still have to acknowledge that, you know, it probably belongs to somebody else.
when you went through that period in 75 or 76 and you contemplated leaving the band and the thing after Tommy, and you also were sort of, I think, taken aback a bit by the Sex Pistols, the Clash. You said it had an effect on you.
It had a positive effect.
Yeah, but you didn't feel dated, useless, finished, you know, that kind of
not
thing.
Not really, no. I mean, I felt feelings like that to some extent anyway, because I felt a kind of impotence in that as growing older and becoming better informed, I realised that a lot of the things that I thought were very easy to change when I was young are very difficult to change. People like me, I mean, I was born in 1945, I've never seen a gun fired, you know, never. And what do? I thank nuclear weapons for that umbrella protection, or do I complain that I've been denied the right to learn to fight? You know, I don't know how to fight. That was the beauty of anarchy. Musical anarchy, or Sex Pistols brand of anarchy, was it was a very, very, very wild and passionate statement of disgust at democracy and what it had produced. It was a statement of disgust at the impotence that has been thrust on us, that we have to live with.
We'll be fighting in the streets with our children at our feet. In the morrows to be worship, we'll be gone. And the men who spurred us on, it's the judgment of our wrong.
I'll be back talking with Pete Townsend about his personal struggles and his new solo album after these messages. We're back on the Inside Track with Pete Townsend. You've had problems with the excesses of the rock and roll lifestyle.
A little bit, yeah. I'm alcoholic, basically. And that has its ramifications on a lot of other different levels. And I hadn't realised it until about the middle of last year. It's very strange because, like, when Keith was alive, I put him in touch with a lot of sort of alcoholic counsellors, and they all said, you know, Keith isn't alcoholic, his problems are elsewhere, but you are. And I said, hold on a minute, no, it's Keith that's got the problems, I'm all right, you know. And I didn't listen. Of course, that was in 75, 76, when Keith was getting really ill through drinking too much. But he wasn't dependent on booze, it was just making him ill, because like everything else, he took too much of it. His problem was just that he was into excess. And there is a facet of me that's about that, that's about, you know, like going in too deep, you know. But aside from all that, completely separate from all that, is I've now got to the point in my life where I cannot afford to take that first drink. I just can't afford to do it, because that means I will be drunk for another 18 months. It will mean that I'll be drunk until it starts to make me ill again. And I was actually getting ill. I went to Paris, I think in October or November, to play on Elton John's album. And when I'd finished doing this track that I worked on, I came back to the hotel and I had a cup of brandies, and then I had another cup of brandies, and then the next day I woke up and I needed a brandy to stop me shaking and stop me feeling nauseous. And the brandy that I drank to stop me feeling shaky and nauseous and to make me feel normal actually made me ill. You know, it made me nervous and irritable, and so it was like there was no way that I could get back to normal again. And I really panicked. So I went back to my normal doctor, and he'd actually prescribed violent exercise, which I was undertaking, which was keeping me alive, basically. I hadn't realised. I'd been doing it for about 18 months, mainly rowing on the river. And I went back to him and said, you know, I'm still not feeling good. So he said, go back and exercise again. How long are you exercising? So I said, well, I'm doing about an hour. You know, I'm doing about 5 miles. He said, well, go and do it for 3 hours. And I said, I can't afford 3 hours every day in a rowing boat. It's crazy, I just can't afford that amount of time. He said, if you don't do it, you're gonna die. Do it, it's keeping you alive. Either that or don't drink. So faced with that alternative of rowing 3 hours a day for the privilege of drinking a bottle of brandy in the evening, I stopped drinking. And I did it with help for the first time. And I just stopped rather than think about it as a period of dryness, you know. I am now sober for life. I'm not going to drink again.
See me, feel me, touch me, heal me. See me, feel me, touch me, heal me. See me.
Pete was also eager to talk about his recently completed solo album, All the Best Cowboys Have Chinese Eyes.
How do you feel that this solo album is different than your last?
It started off with a very, very aggressive experimentation. Originally, there was going to be a lot of poetry on it. And that's what I was experimenting on when I was in New York. And I'd done a lot of experiments with echo effects on percussion. But in a sense, what happened is that those early experiments, they were all quite satisfactory and interesting, but it always comes back down to the song, whether or not the song's got any real guts and any real need to express itself. And once I started recording for real with Chris Thomas, I started to write in a slightly more formal manner. What I did actually is which is slightly different from the last album, is I put a group together. And I used the same group throughout the whole record. And so when we started into rehearsals, we did 2 weeks rehearsals before the album started, I started to realise that this format had a kind of a potential in itself. And I wrote 2 songs especially for this lineup. One was called Sea Refuses No River and the other is called Slit Skirts. In fact, Sea Refuses No River's come out sounding a little bit Bruce Springsteen. It's got a glockenspiel on it, which he uses a lot.
That's because one little refrain sounds a little like Born to Run. Yeah.
It's because I've got because of the percussionist in there. It was just being used. It's more of a continuation on From Empty Glass than Face Dances, the Who album was. Well, I've now decided that there is one kind of writing for the band and there's one kind of writing for me.
How would you define each?
I don't really know. I think there's more with the band. It's more of writing to a brief. I think more of writing, bearing in mind that I am writing songs which other people in the group have got to stand by and have got to feel good about. And that when I'm writing for myself, I can just afford to get into a more of a kind of consciousness stream, you know, allow whatever comes out to stand for whatever it is. You know.
Which is harder to do.
I find writing for the band the most difficult. God, it's the easiest thing in the world to just sit and scribble.
Than a king, the minutes of the day were golden. I recall it when the joint passed round, my body felt a little colder.
That song Communication on the album just hit me.
What it's about is about, it's a song really about people pretending to communicate when they're not and using very flowery, what I call lyrical prose. Instead of just saying whatever it is they want to say, using hiding behind their words. And so I took the word communication, which should really speak for itself, and broke it up into bits. So you've got, it turns into the word come quite nicely, come, 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 come. And it turns into commie quite nicely, commie, commie, commie. And come you, and things like that, and I just broke the word up and then followed it with a bit of absolutely dire schoolboy poetry, you know, with things like Briolette tears and frozen masks and the backs of whale and icebergs on frozen seas and all that stuff, just to demonstrate that there are really 2 ways of killing the cat, you know. It's just a song about the need to really say and to speak and to talk about, I hope that the song gets across that mood through the urgency of the music behind it. It's a good track, that.
Yeah.
Come, 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 come,
Pete feels about old Who songs when the Inside Track returns.
Now back to the Inside Track.
Do you still feel that the Who is sort of carrying around this big knapsack? As I think it was you said to Greil. Knapsack.
Well, of old songs.
Of old songs, yes.
And old images.
To me, you said a truckload of crap, I think is the way you described it.
It's possible. Yeah, I think we still are. I mean, I don't think we'll ever exorcise the past. I don't know whether we really want to. You remember earlier on I was talking about tradition, you know, the fact that the Who do have this sort of reverence for the stage as a platform, something that's been there for a long time that we sort of move on and off of. You know, when we're off it, we're very aware that somebody else is on it the night after. You know, you find a lot of people in the business forget the fact that, you know, when they go into Madison Square Garden, that they're not the first, you know. And the way they strut around the dressing room, you'd imagine that they were the only people that ever played there. You know, I've seen it. It's just fantastic. And one of the things that we're very conscious of is that you go to a place to play a concert to make people feel good. And it can sometimes really be annoying to people to not just get that song which they're hoping to hear out of the way, in a sense, you know, to get it struck off. I remember once in Britain, there was this incredible, obsessive thing that used to happen in the audience. A whole section of the audience would start to shout out for Magic Bus. And it would go on all the way through the concert. And if we didn't actually play the song after the concert, a whole crowd of people would come back and go, "Why didn't you play Magic Bus?" And I'd say to them, what's this thing about Magic Bus? You know, it's just a song. You know, I mean, it's meaningless. It's not meaningless, it's fantastic. It's the most important thing you've ever written. So in the end, I said to Roger, let's play the thing early in the act and get it over with, you know. And then it would actually, I mean, then we'd get people saying, "Play Magic Bus again!" But, you know, partly the fact is they've shown up, they've driven from wherever it is, they got their ticket, they've come there, they want to hear Magic Bus. Well, play Magic Bus. You know?
Every day I get in the queue, get on a bus that takes me to you.
Did you once say that every Who loony knew where you lived, and you sort of were pleased by this?
No, I hate that.
You do hate that?
Yeah. I like people being able to write to me. I like to feel accessible, but not exposed, and there is a difference. I think if I was a fan of the band, it would be one of the things that I think I quite like about it, the fact that there was a possibility for a feeling of closeness without feeling like you were infringing on somebody's privacy. But I mean, a lot of people do actually come and stand outside the house and gaze up at the windows as though, you know, as though I was, I don't know, Salvador Dali or something. You go up to the window and you hear a scream and you look down and it's somebody who's been waiting outside for 6 hours. And then sort of sees you look out of the window and can't believe it. You know, I look out of my windows, you know, every now and again. And that's what I think is really weird, you know. But they don't really want to meet you, and they don't really want to talk to you. They just want to keep you over there. And that's what I try not to do.
You know. Still think that it's all that sweet and naive and innocent on the part of fans? I mean, even after Lennon.
I'd prefer to write to them than not write to them. And luckily, most of the people that write to me have something, some kind of true intercourse there. You know, there is. And whereas Lennon was, funnily enough, like he was an accessible figure in some ways, but he's also very remote. You see, the tragedy with Lennon was that all that quietude, the uniqueness of his relationship with Yoko and the cherished homely passion that they shared is lost. And I do think that with success in any business that is about communication, you know, that you've got to accept the responsibilities that come with it to some extent. Maybe responsibility is not the right word. I don't know. You know, somebody that goes into politics accepts this automatically. You know, but people in entertainment don't, for some reason. They think they can become people's heroes and get everybody saying how wonderful they are and take all that love and all that affection, live off it, spend everybody's money, and then get privacy at the end of the day and be able to say, okay, stop loving me, stop adoring me, goodbye, I'm going to go and crawl under a stone. You can't do that.
Stardom and action, that's all they got. Stardom and action, that's all they got. Stardom and action, that's all they got.
Maturity is something that you suffer from. You know, you suffer from it. You know, you get mature and then you think, God, I'm so boring. You know, it's difficult to not be bored by yourself, even when you're not boring other people. And when you get bored with yourself, it's because your life has fallen into a strict pattern and you've lost enjoying the little things, you know, which you should be enjoying. I suppose I had a close shave up to last Christmas, a very, very close shave. You know, I could be dead now. And so I feel both lucky to be alive, but also very content with whatever it is I've got. You know what I mean? It's a weird feeling. It's like, I hope it doesn't pass, because it's a great feeling.
I watch you sit and twitch you more than much between your teeth. You seem to have a knack of moving, it's in time to repeat. Face dances tonight. Chances, moonlight, face dances tonight. Make chances, moonlight. I can't be distracted by the structure.
It was great to see Pete in such good spirits. Not only can we enjoy his just released solo album, we can look forward to hearing a new Who album later this year. We also have more to look forward to on The Inside Track. Coming up in just a moment, Lou Reed.